pediatric vaccine education, the baby bust in the recession, and a look at colorectal cancer screening techniques. Plus, we're going to look at atrial flutter in the tip of the week this week. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have some good news articles coming up, and then later on in the show, our normal tip of the week segment. But first, I want to welcome all of the brand new listeners. I know we have a lot of new listeners coming on board this time of year looking for information about nursing. Maybe they're getting ready to enter a nursing program, or you're a nurse who's found The Nursing Show for the first time. Whatever the case may be, I do want to remind you that there is a home on the web for The Nursing Show, and that is nursingshow.com. You can find links to all the articles in the show notes for each and every episode over there in the show notes tab at the top of the page. You can find other articles and news items and commentary posted up throughout the course of each week. And of course, you'll find the links there in the upper right-hand side to go ahead and subscribe in iTunes to get the show for free there in the Zune Marketplace. Follow me on Twitter, Facebook, all of those things and options are available for you as ways to stay up to date with what's going on with The Nursing Show. So get involved, become an active part of The Nursing Show community. Of course, part of that option is to send me your email comments. If you have heard something in a show, you want to correct me, maybe I've misspoken, maybe you want me to clarify, or you have a question, send me those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com, nursingshow@gmail.com. I respond to every single email. It may take me a couple of days, but I will get back to you, and maybe I'll be able to share your email with the listeners here on The Nursing Show. And of course, you can always follow me over at Facebook as well, facebook.com/podmedic or facebook.com/nursingshow for The Nursing Show fan page. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'm going to lead off with a story. I think I've covered some items on this in the past, but it bears revisiting as more news pops up in my radar about this. The American Academy of Pediatrics is really in the forefront, as they should be, in prevention of pediatric injuries, pediatric illnesses. And one of the things that I'm a big proponent of is educating people about vaccines and giving them the correct information. There's so much garbage out there on the internet right now urging parents not to vaccinate their children, that their vaccination is going to cause them some injury or illness, cause autism, which is not the case. And there is ample proof and evidence out there that there is no correlation between vaccines and these internet myths that are floating around out there. And finally, the American Academy of Pediatrics has launched a project, a campaign to really bring about awareness of why we have these vaccines, why they are so valuable. And I think part of it is that we just don't have the cultural memory anymore to remember that our grandparents lost siblings to preventable illnesses, illnesses that are vaccinated for today. These illnesses caused their siblings to die in early stages of their lives. And why should we not be protecting our children in the same way? And this is just goes to show that people just don't remember these things. They don't remember the horror of the time when you had a family, you expected, it was almost unheard of not to lose a child at some point in your life as a parent. What a horrible thing to face up to and know kind of in your core that one of your children is likely to die before they reach adulthood because of these illnesses that are so common in that time frame. Now we have these vaccines that have largely eradicated or prevented these illnesses from becoming severe in this day and age. I'm talking about things like polio, measles, diphtheria, whooping cough, all of these diseases out there that could stage a comeback if we lose the immunity that is brought about by widespread vaccinations. And we see some of these illnesses making a comeback and on the rise because of relaxed vaccination schedules by parents because they are so afraid that something's going to happen to their child. They're going to lose the, they're going to become autistic because of the vaccine. And that's just not true. These things are out there on the internet. And I think it's important for us as medical professionals, along with the American Academy of Pediatrics, to raise awareness in our patients and in our communities and not let celebrities with their own agenda and their own personal tragic stories that they have some anecdotal evidence that there might be a cause for their child's illness. They come on because of their celebrity power and act as if they have factual information, and they don't. And it's a shame that this is the case, but we're putting many, many children at risk because of bad medical information and bad research and bad science being promoted as the truth. And we as medical professionals, if you have a blog, a website, if you have a forum with which to promote these things, promote good science, promote factual information, promote links to credible resources like the Centers for Disease Control. We can do a lot to change what people are finding out there when they go to search for vaccine safety. Because right now, they search for vaccine safety and all the crackpot sites come up first in the search engines. We need to go ahead and provide enough other resources out there to start drowning out the noise that is covering up good information. And the American Academy of Pediatrics is starting a whole campaign called Protect Tomorrow to talk about these diseases, these preventable illnesses that the vaccines take care of. And I'm looking forward to seeing more about this. We'll be linking to these things in the future, and I'm hoping that we will be able to continue to promote this initiative on this show and the other programs that I'm associated with. And maybe we can have some experts on to talk about that in a future episode. Talking about children and infants and young babies, have you seen in your hospital or in your community that there's been a baby bust in the current recession, in the current economic climate? Well, there's an article I picked up out of a California newspaper, and this newspaper is looking at the fact that local maternity wards are empty. Birth control clinics are full, and they're alleging this is because of the economic times, fewer babies being born as parents try to cut back on costs. And one of those costs is anybody who's a parent knows, is children are costly, and infants especially are costly, and then they're costly again when they're teenagers and start driving. But I'm going through that particular horror right now. But certainly, there is seems to be some correlation here. I wonder if any of the rest of you are seeing similar declines in birth rates. I tried to find some information on it, and of course, it's still too soon to collect that data over at places like the CDC and the FDA that maintain a lot of this information, and the United States Census sites that track birth rates, death rates. It's still too early to track the last 12 months accurately there, but I'm waiting for the next report to come out to see, did we see a dip in childbirth during the current crisis? And so people may be looking for better options for birth control and looking for other ways to protect themselves to stop from having children at this time. And we need to provide them with that information. So make sure that you're aware that people might be looking for this and at least have access to some places you can point them to in the community, additional resources to provide your patients so that they have the right information with which to work. Again, it comes down to providing credible, high quality, good medical information for our patients. Speaking of good medical information, you know, we were all talking about different types of colon cancer, of different cancer screenings in general, and there's been a lot of looks and studies at prevention and ways to predict and to determine early if there's a risk for certain types of cancers and certain types of late-in-life illnesses like cardiovascular disease. There's a study out of the UK that is looking at two different types of screening techniques. One is your standard colonoscopy, which is a little more invasive. Less invasive is a flexible sigmoidoscopy. And they were trying to determine, looking at 17,000 men and women in this study. And this study is looking at which one is more predictive, or are they equal in their predictive nature? Because certainly, there's additional cost involved with a more involved procedure. A more invasive procedure has additional risks and side effects associated with it. So in a patient profile, where you're going to have higher risks, higher medical costs associated with those risks, is there a better option? And this particular study determined that there seemed to be no significant difference in the predictive nature and in finding and removing precancerous polyps when they used a sigmoidoscopy, the less invasive option. And so it's something to consider. It seems that there's some evidence to look at this. And as you know, the UK and other countries, the United States, are all looking for ways to reduce healthcare costs, these higher cost, more invasive procedures should be reserved for situations that require a more in-depth determination of what's going on. And if a less invasive procedure can cover the bases, well, certainly they should be looking at those things as cost-cutting measures. And we need to, again, make sure our patients are aware of this, that patients are educated about the risks and benefits for any procedure, and that they are provided the knowledge and information they need to make an informed patient decision. And, you know, as nurses, that falls to us to make sure our patients understand what's happening to them, what's going on with their healthcare process. So you look up all of these news articles in the show notes for this episode over at nursingshow.com, and I look forward to hearing back from you and getting comments on what you think about these particular news stories. Time for this week's tip of the week. And we covered atrial fibrillation a few weeks back, and I thought I would jump in and kind of cover its partner in crime, atrial flutter, here in this episode as we try to bring out occasional ECG reviews here on The Nursing Show. So let's jump on into this segment on atrial flutter. So what are we talking about today with atrial flutter? Well, we're going to review the conduction anatomy. I know we've done this in the past, but it bears review because atrial flutter is a particular type of conduction anomaly, and it's something you should be aware of. We're going to look at the physiology of atrial flutter, what are some of the common causes of atrial flutter and side effects, and then we'll review some of the more common treatments associated with atrial flutter. Let's look at cardiac conduction, and this is just a brief review, but remember that the normal heartbeat originates in the sinoatrial node, the SA node, which is high up near the entry point for the superior vena cava up in the right atrium. And it originates there, spreads out across the right atrium and into the left atrium. And then some of the nodal pathways come back together at the AV node, the atrioventricular node, where things are kind of paused for a split second and allowed the conduction to continue to finish the contraction of the atrial squeeze. Then that is passed along down through the AV node into the bundle of His and into the bundle branches, the Purkinje fibers as well. And you can see this progression as it goes down through the different areas of these nodal pathways. And the Purkinje fibers then cause the coordinated squeeze up of the ventricles, and this is what causes the pulmonary circulation to cause a gas exchange in the lungs, and also the systemic circulation and blood pressure that occurs with the systolic squeeze associated with the left ventricle. Now, particularly in the atrial conduction, again, we talk about the sinoatrial node and the AV node, and so as these pathways where the signals are sent out to various sides of the atria occur, if damage were to occur to the heart muscle somewhere in there, there could be a place where the pathway is interrupted. And in some cases, that pathway may actually cause the signal to be sent back out in a different pathway and cause a reentry of the same signal. So we send a signal once, it goes out, part of it bounces back. It's like having a mirror somewhere in that conduction pathway. It bounces that signal back into the other muscle cells that have already started to repolarize, causing them to contract again. And it's this reentry pathway that is commonly seen in atrial flutter. So what are we looking at here with cardiac anatomy? Remember, we've got the four chambers of the heart, the right atrium, the left atrium, squeezing down into the right and left ventricle. Much like we looked at in a previous segment on atrial fibrillation, we see that if the atria are contracting in an uncoordinated fashion, if they're not contracting effectively enough, if they're not allowed to refill and squeeze out again, there can be blood pooling in the corners. It's not as much of a problem with atrial flutter, but it can be seen. And so whenever you have blood pooling, blood starts to clot. And so these atrial arrhythmias can sometimes cause patients to throw blood clots more frequently. Atrial fibrillation, as we've talked in other episodes, is certainly much more commonly seen because of the complete uncoordination seen in a fibrillation situation. Atrial flutter is more coordinated and more regular, but there's still an incomplete atrial squeeze, and we can still see blood pooling and possibility of blood clots happening in this situation. And so we have all of these places where the ventricles actually send out their packages of blood clots, if they get sent into the ventricles, into the lungs, causing pulmonary emboli, or into the systemic circulation, where it can cause a stroke, it can cause peripheral blood clots, it can cause cardiac blood clots if it comes back into the cardiac arteries. So what is a flutter? Again, I talked about it. It's the second most common tachyarrhythmia we see after atrial fibrillation. It usually occurs in a reentry pathway in the right atrium. And what this happens, again, is like there's a mirror in there. It causes that signal to recycle very rapidly. And we can see atrial rates of 240 to 400 beats per minute. And this is where we get that sawtoothed appearance, very rapid response. And, of course, how fast are the ventricles keeping up? The AV node doesn't pass signals through that quickly. So how fast are the ventricles responding to what signals that are getting through? And this can show up as a tachycardia and ventricular reaction, or we might have a slower ventricular response. We may have medications that are managing the atrial flutter, causing this slower ventricular response to originate. But we certainly need to watch and see what's happening, because if the ventricular rate becomes too high, we have incomplete ventricular filling at that point, and that increased ventricular rate will cause decreased blood pressure and other issues. Usually, there's a regular ventricular response, so we're going to see atrial flutter as a regular rhythm. Usually, we have a regular atrial rate, and usually, the rate is passed into the ventricles at a regular ratio. So we might have a 4-to-1 conduction ratio. Every 4 P waves, we have a QRS complex. That's what, or maybe a 3-to-1 or a 2-to-1, depending on what we are seeing on the monitors. Usually there's a regular response. Now, if there is some kind of AV node problem, if there's been a previous cardiac event that's caused damage to the AV node, some other medications can cause incomplete AV node transmission, and so we may see an irregular heartbeat. So it's not always completely regular, but we will see a regular P wave rhythm, not necessarily in a regular ventricular response, and so there may be some level of heart block involved here. What causes a flutter? Similar to what we saw in atrial fibrillation, hypertension, coronary heart disease, diabetes, pulmonary emboli, pericarditis, and CHF patients are all at increased risk for having a flutter. And this is because this is as a result of some cardiac cellular death, cardiac ischemia, where some portion of that transmission pathway in the atria is not working properly and is somehow reflecting that rhythm, that impulse, back into the higher levels of the food chain and gets retransmitted over and over and over again, and that reentry pathway occurs. And so anyone with a prior history of a cardiac event, even a cardiac event that was not diagnosed, so somebody had a heart attack, didn't realize it, kept going about their day because it was a mild event and it seemed to self-resolve, but this patient now has some death in their cardiac muscle, that can cause issues and cause this reentry. Also, interestingly enough, digitalis toxicity can cause a flutter. So be aware that there are medications out there that can cause this, and DIG is one of those meds that you want to look at. If someone's taking DIG and they have a flutter on the rhythm, it may be caused by DIG levels. Patients, especially elderly patients, screw up their medications. They think they took it, or they forgot they took it first thing in the morning, and they take a medication again at breakfast, and suddenly their toxicity levels are up. So be prepared to draw additional blood to look at DIG levels or to put that order through. So be aware of that. Also, patients that are post-operative for cardiac surgery can also have increased risk for a flutter. The cardiac surgery could cause some damage as they are doing bypass surgery and they're suturing the new arteries in place and trying to bypass a blockage. They get in there and they have this surgical procedure, there could be some damage caused during the surgery to the cardiac muscle and the atria, and that could be, they could be interfering with the atrial pathways and cause this type of reentry rhythm. So these are all risk factors. Again, the effects are of a flutter, not usually, at least in what I've seen personally and also in the literature I've looked at, not as severe as atrial fibrillation. There is inefficient cardiac ejection from the atria into the ventricles, and that inefficient cardiac ejection, depending on how inefficient it is, could cause some pooling and blood clots to form. But it's a more regular rhythm, and usually the ventricular response is not as severe and unpredictable. So it needs to be treated, and it can be treated, but it, often we'll see not as severe as atrial fibrillation. But it should be taken, looked at carefully. And again, the patient should be treated carefully. We don't want to treat just the monitor. We treat the patient. If the patient has signs of a flutter, but they have no signs of some kind of hemodynamic compromise, then we want to get them triage. We want to get them in to see the physician. We want to get them in to get the definitive treatment they need to manage the A-flutter, but we don't want to just knee-jerk reaction, go right to our ACLS guidelines and cardiovert these patients, because they don't need electrical cardioversion unless it is an emergent situation where they have a hemodynamic compromise. We'll see tachycardias, again, depending on the ventricular response rate, and it's usually a regular response. Sometimes hypotension, again, because this is a more regular rhythm, we have better cardiac output than you see commonly in atrial fibrillation, but not all the time. And because there's associated cardiac ischemia possibly involved or other cardiac symptoms involved with CHF and other things, there could be other problems with their cardiac system causing hypotension along with this. Again, be prepared for clot formation and be prepared to have patients prescribed with some kind of anti-clotting agents, getting probably starting them with heparin, moving them into Coumadin, managing that, and then treating the A-flutter, similar to what you'd see in atrial fibrillation. Again, patients may be getting into CHF situations depending on where the problems in the the problems in the atria are, and usually this is responding to a ventricular dysfunction of one kind or another when they have CHF. So again, this is that a flutter often accompanies other problems. So if you see a flutter, look for other problems in the cardiac system. There may be previous events showing up there, not just in the atria, but we may see signs of ventricular damage and poor cardiac ejection and things like that. Recognizing a flutter, it's a regular atrial rhythm. In the fibrillation, the atrial fibrillation segment a couple of weeks ago, I think I talked about being irregular and irregularly irregular a lot. I didn't actually say, a listener checked back in with me and said, I didn't actually say no discernible P waves. I meant no discernible P waves, but I didn't apparently say it. So there are no discernible P waves in atrial fibrillation. However, in a flutter, you should be able to see a regular atrial rhythm, regular P waves showing up there, often because they're so fast and what's going on, they appear peaked, not rounded like you'd see in a disorganized fibrillation. So you see definable peaked P waves, and they are regular in atrial rhythm. We see that new sawtooth, that sharp peaked teeth on the saw, and we'll see that in the upcoming slide. Slow AV conduction, again, usually 2-to-1, 3-to-1, or 4-to-1 between the P waves and the QRS complexes. So look and see what the response rate is to determine how bad the cardiac response is as far as the ventricular response. Understand that there may be varied conduction. So even though the atrial rhythm might be regular, the ventricular rhythm is not always regular. So be aware of that. AV conduction may not be consistently regular, and so you may have an irregular ventricular rhythm, so therefore an irregular pulse. But when you look at the chart, look at your EKG, you're looking right there at a regular atrial rhythm with an irregular ventricular conduction. ventricular rate, usually around 150 or so. It seems to be pretty standard, and I've seen that before. You know, for some reason, a flutter just seems to settle the ventricles down at a certain position and doesn't have that hugely rapid ventricular response, but it can happen, so be aware of that. But if you see a regular atrial rhythm and a ventricular rate around 150, think a flutter right away if there seems to be no conduction or conduction anomalies. In other words, we have a slow AV conduction and the conduction ratios that is discussed earlier. Again, if you look at a picture of a flutter, you see that sharp sawtoothed sign. You know, sometimes people have said to me, turn it upside down, and you definitely see it because the QRS complexes tend to have a high positive deflection compared to the P waves. If you turn it over, the decreased negative deflection in lead two of the QRS complex, along with these peaked regular atrial conduction, atrial P waves, show up as a sharp sawtooth pattern. And so that's something to keep in mind. Turn that EKG over and look for the sawtooth. Again, let's just review real quickly. We want to make sure we recognize and understand a flutter. Understand that there are treatments for A-flutter out there, including calcium channel blockers, amiodarone, other antiarrhythmic medications. We want to be careful, stay away from things like lidocaine, because, again, we have inefficient atrial conduction anomaly going on, and we have a ventricular response rate. If we kill that ventricular response, we kill the blood pressure. So we want to be very careful about decreasing or anesthetizing the ventricular response very much when we see signs that there's some kind of AV channel block going on or AV block going on because of that reduced conduction ratio. So be very careful. We also, if the patient is symptomatic, we're talking hypotension, diaphoresis, altered mental status, they are showing signs of fluid in the lungs, decreased everything, and hemodynamic compromise in general, consider synchronized electrical cardioversion for these patients. And identify the causes. What's going on with this patient? Is there a DIG toxicity situation going on? And if there is, be prepared to treat that, because that's a preventable and reversible cause, and we can take care of that. Is there a possibility they had a recent cardiac event? We need to possibly forward them onto a cath lab. Clearly, if they're being seen with a flutter, they're probably under the if it's a first-time situation, they may not even have a cardiologist. So again, a referral is necessary, and we want to make sure these patients find a physician that they can work with and continue to see on a regular basis if they've got cardiac symptoms, and this would be one of those situations. Also, be prepared for side effects. Again, emboli can form in a flutter, as in atrial fibrillation. So you want to be prepared to have these patients on anticoagulants. And in some situations, they may be on some form of thrombolytic. You need to be prepared to administer those medications, be prepared for the side effects that might show up, and be prepared to monitor their lab values appropriately. Don't forget to follow up on the additional information. I always provide additional resource links to high-quality sites and respected medical program sites so that you can find additional information to back up what I'm talking about here and get more in-depth information. I can provide you a brief overview of some of these things, but it's your job to go ahead and figure out how it applies to your own scope of practice and exactly how you can apply it in your neck of the woods. And that means you need to follow up and get the additional information. And you'll find all of that over at nursingshow.com. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind all of you that you can find a lot more information, including links to everything discussed in this and every other episode, over at nursingshow.com. You'll find links to the show notes right there at the top of the page under the show notes link. You can also look back and check out all of the great articles and other information you'll find available at nursingshow.com. If you want to comment on this episode or any other episode, you can, of course, comment on any article at the Nursing Show site. There's a comments link. You can also send us email in. Our new email address is nursingshow@gmail.com, nursingshow@gmail.com. Catch us by email. Send us in your tips, suggestions, links to news items, and yes, corrections, because we want to make sure we have the best possible information here available for you on the Nursing Show. Don't forget, you can also find me on Twitter and Facebook under the handle PodMedic, and you can also find and become a fan of the Nursing Show fan page. You'll get updates, information, and usually early access to The Nursing Show. When I record it, I post the links up there earlier in the week. Time to close out the show, and I'll wrap up with a song by a band by the name of Mercury in Summer called No, I Won't Let You Go. You'll find this over at the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com, and you should check out the links in the show notes for this artist, as well as the links where you can go ahead and purchase one of their songs. You know, spend a dollar, the cost of a cup of soda or less, and go ahead and let this person know, these artists know, that you appreciate them sharing their music with you on shows like The Nursing Show. I'll be back again next week with some more great information. In the meantime, I want to remind all of you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic and host here at The Nursing Show. I'll be back next Friday with another episode. In the meantime, don't forget to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Today, no, I won't let you go. No way.